One thing I did miss out, I just picked up the calendar for next month, and I forgot to mention the dinner in Jackson on Friday evening, the 9th of June. Still a couple of weeks away, but I wanted to let everybody in Jackson know so you can plan on that. We'll be going down there for that on the Friday evening. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is a name you may not be able to spell at the present time, but it's a name you're going to hear a lot over the next few months because he's threatening to wipe us out, to wipe us off the face of the earth. And, of course, he's threatening to do that to the Jews, too. If you saw the Lansing State Journal yesterday, this article is titled 100-plus Iranians Vow to be Suicide Bombers. It's 100-plus here, but there was something last month about 1,000 that had volunteered to be nuclear suicide bombers. In other words, they would try and bring a nuclear bomb into the United States and Britain and Israel. Those are the three countries they're threatening to destroy. And, you know, they'd blow themselves up with a nuclear bomb, with a nuclear device. But here are these Iranians vowing to be suicide bombers. And, you know, this president really has got it in for Israel in particular, but also the United States and Britain, so all three countries. You know, it's interesting that in World War II, Hitler wiped out 6 million Jews. Israel today has now more than 50% of all the world's Jews. This was not the case for a long time. When I was in school, New York City had more Jews than Israel did. But now a lot of Jews are moving back. In fact, I've noticed over the past 2 or 3 years in flying across the Atlantic that there's more and more Jews on the planes. You know, the guys have always got their beanies on, you know, so that you know that they're Jewish. And, you know, there seems to be a revival of religious feeling amongst many Jews, and in particular younger Jews. I've met quite a few young families on the planes with many children. You know, 6 children is not uncommon today. And so, you know, today Israel has more Jews than it's ever had before, 5.2 million. And they hope to have 6 million within 5 years, which of course means exactly the same as they lost in World War II during the Holocaust, when Hitler had 6 million Jews annihilated during that period of genocide. So it is rather interesting that Iran's Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is threatening to wipe out Israel and, once again, could kill 6 million Jews. And it makes you think that perhaps his spiritual source is getting his inspiration from the same place as Hitler did in World War II, you know, from the same demons. It does make you wonder why it is that so often throughout history people have wanted to wipe out the Jews. And, of course, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is not the first Iranian to want to wipe out the Jews either. If you look in the Bible, you see in the book of Esther that a previous leader of Iran, which was called Persia until recently, it was called Persia, I think, up until 1946, so right up until fairly recently, a previous leader of Persia tried to wipe out the Jews, and that was in the book of Esther. If you look at the Tyndale Bible commentary on Esther, it mentions this. It says, Esther's family was one of many Israelite families that chose to remain in Persia rather than return to Israel. The Jews first returned to Palestine in 536 BC. Ezra and Nehemiah returned to Jerusalem in 475 BC and then 444 BC. So Esther lived in the period of King Xerxes I, who is also identified in the Bible as Ahasuerus. He reigned from 486 to 465 BC. Her story took place after Ezra's temple reforms and before Nehemiah's rebuilding of Jerusalem's wall. Just as Israel was striving to live once again in God's land, the political forces of Persia were about to try to destroy God's people. You know, the analogies are amazing. Because here, if you remember, you know, the book of Daniel, that was when the Jews were taken into captivity in Babylon. And they were held there, of course, for 70 years. And then some went back to Judah. And then others stayed behind in Persia. If you remember when Ralph Levy came here to speak, he's a lecturer at Ambassador Bible Center. Ralph Levy's ancestry is Jewish, and his parents actually were in Persia. And they could trace their ancestry back to that particular time when, you know, Daniel, when in the time of just after the Babylonian Empire in the 6th century, in that particular time, in Daniel's time, the Jews were allowed to go back. Some stayed behind in Persia, and they were there until fairly recently. There were a few million of them until, you know, our lifetimes, but it's only recently that the authorities have turned against them, particularly in the past 25 years. So a lot of those Jews have left, and Ralph's parents left, I think in the 1950s, they left Persia to go to England, and they've been living in England ever since. But, you know, it makes you realize, really, it's not a very long period of time that we're talking about here. 2,500 years may seem like a long period of time, and in some ways it is, but, you know, in a way it's not, that you've still got people in Iran or Persia who were taken there, whose ancestors were taken there when the Jews were taken as slaves by Nebuchadnezzar in ancient Babylon. Now, the story of Esther takes place in 484 B.C. We can date it exactly because of what happened historically. So 484 B.C. So we're going to go through the book of Esther today because it is an inspiration. You know, when you consider what is taking place right now. I mean, this is a serious threat from the president of Iran. It's not to be taken lightly because there are various things that can be done. And while you're turning to Esther, I'll just mention those things because, you know, it is important to realize the seriousness of this. First of all, you know, they are rapidly developing nuclear weapons. Western countries are trying to stop them, but nothing has worked so far. And it doesn't seem as if anything will. And secondly, the president of Iran has threatened a real Holocaust because they deny the first Holocaust took place. They've threatened a real Holocaust, not against the Jews. They've threatened that against us, against the United States, that they'll do to us what we claim was done to the Jews in World War II. They deny it was done to the Jews. They're threatening to wipe out Israel. They already have the capacity to attack Israel with the missiles that they've got available to them right now, but they don't have a nuclear warhead to attach to those missiles. But you know, Israel is not a very big country. Just one nuclear weapon aimed at the right spot could probably wipe everybody out. Just one attack, that's all. Just one day. Now, you know, Israel already has, as part of its national policy, it's called the Masada policy, the Masada defense. You know, Masada was the place where, when the Jews rebelled against the Romans in 66 AD, some of the Jewish zealots retreated to a place called Masada, which is high up. I've been there, and it's on a very high hill. And they held out there against the Romans for a long period of time, 3 or 4 years. And rather than surrender to the Romans, they all committed suicide, except for 2 people. So, you know, they have that as a national policy, that they will not surrender to anybody. But secondly, they also have the Samuel defense. You know, when, Samson. When Samson pulled down the pillars of the temple and everybody was killed, you know, they believe they should do the same thing. So if they are faced with destruction, they will bring everybody else down. That is their, you know, avowed policy, that they're not going to let themselves be destroyed again and go through what they went through in World War II. So, you know, we now have this situation where the Iranians are threatening to destroy them. But also, Iran can do a great deal to us. Their nuclear weapons, when they have them, and by some estimates it's going to be later this year, some say it'll take 3 or 4 years, so who knows exactly when. But, you know, when they have nuclear weapons, they will be able to attack American and British bases in the Middle East. So they would be able to, you know, hit any of our bases with all of our military personnel there. Also, they can hit the oil fields. which would up the price of oil just astronomically. I mean, all authorities say, just even the rumors of an attack would send oil to over $100 a barrel, which would mean over $5 a gallon for gas. But also, it could, an actual attack, if they destroy some of the oil fields, it might push the price up to, a couple of $100 a barrel. Who knows? I mean, nobody knows where it would end, because it's all governed by the law of supply and demand. So the less supply you have, the higher the price is going to be. So, these are serious threats. Also, these suicide bombers are threatening to attack us here on our home territory. So not attack over there, but attack here. Because some in the Middle East are starting to believe that's the only way we can be defeated, is to come here. So, again, we're talking about nuclear devices. So, we're in a very serious situation. Now, let me offset that with something. Before we actually go through Daniel, let me just speculate for a moment here, because I think it's important. Look at Daniel chapter 11. We know there is this coming clash of civilizations between the king of the north and the king of the south, which takes place at the very end time in Daniel 11. And just so that you don't go away terribly worried after what I have to say, I want you to see here that Iran is not mentioned in Daniel 11 and verse 14. It says, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, shall attack the king of the north, or push against him. If you look at the prophecy here in Hebrew in Daniel 11, it's an attack or a push. Could be terrorism, could be the oil being cut off, could be a number of different things, economic pressure in some ways. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. So here we get the king of the north, a revived Roman Empire, these 10 nations that are coming together. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. The glorious land is the Holy Land, what we today call Israel. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. That's basically the Jordanians, and also the Turks, Turkey. Two countries which are allied to the U.S., seemingly pro-Western, so they seem to escape here. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. So, you see, it's interesting here. The focus is not over by Iran. It's actually west of Iran. So it would seem to me that, the king of the south is not the Iranians. However, what's happening in Iran is spreading. Because in Iran, in 1979, the Shah, who was very pro-American, was overthrown. And you had this fanatical Islamic fundamentalist group ruling the country ever since. And their influence has spread. But the good thing is, from our point of view, the Iranians are Shiite Muslims. And the most of the Arabs are Sunni Muslims, and they don't get along with each other. So that's been good. Having said that, Islamic fundamentalism seems to be spreading everywhere throughout the Middle East, Shiite and Sunni. In fact, Osama bin Laden's Sunni sect of Islam, the Wahhabi sect, is the most militant of all. It's even worse than the Shiites. Now, I'm writing an article right now, I'm supposed to have it due by next Friday, on this whole business with Iran. And our tentative title, the title may change, but the tentative title is Messiah or Madman. Because, Ahmadinejad is what's known as a Twelver. The Twelvers are the Shiites who believe that the 12th Imam of the Shia religion is going to return as a Messiah. And the 12th Imam was disappeared, I think, in the 900s, well over 1,000 years ago. And they expect him to return in pretty much the same way as we expect Jesus Christ to return. So they have their own version of a Messiah returning, the Mahdi, as they call him. And they expect this 12th Imam to come back. Now, the 12ers are divided into two. You have those who believe that the Imam will return, and then the whole world will be forced to become Muslim. But there were those who believed that the whole world must be forced to become Muslim first, and then the 12 imam will return. And of course, those who believe that the whole world must be Islamic first are the ones that we have to be most afraid of, because they're the ones who will do anything to bring this about, including killing as many people as possible. Remember, Muhammad's last words to his followers were that they should go out and kill everybody until there is no one left except those who say there is no God but Allah. Now, that is what he said in 632 AD, and this is, what people are taught. You may have seen this week, the U.S. State Department has complained to the Saudi Arabians, who are supposed to be our friends, that their school textbooks basically denigrate everything we believe. They put down Christianity. They claim that, the whole world must be Muslim. So, this is what kids are indoctrinated with from the moment they start at school. And, the hatred is just so intense. These history books apparently describe Jews as pigs and monkeys. And that was the complaint that the State Department made this week regarding these particular books. Anyway, then it continues in Daniel 11, but news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. Maybe Iran comes in at this point. News from the east. Iran is becoming a major power. And it's interesting, by the way, the Iranians believe, and many other countries also believe, the Russians believe this too. They believe that we are a declining power on our way out. We are what's known as a sunset power. They are what's known as sunrise powers. They are on the way up. And the Iranians believe at some point we're going to pull out of Iraq, which seems increasingly likely. And, of course, when that happens, it will be seen around the world as a defeat. And, then, of course, they'll be emboldened. And of course, also, they'll fill the gap. The Iranians already are the biggest single influence in Iraq. So they're going to take advantage of these things. So, this is the background. So I think a lot more has got to happen. That's what I'm saying here. It's not just Iran we have to watch, because all these other countries, something's going to happen, because these other countries are involved. They're mentioned here. I suspect, my own personal feeling is, that a lot of these countries are going to fall to Islamic fundamentalism. And you can see that happening even now. It's happened already in a number of places. For example, in Palestine, when they had a free election, what happened? The fundamentalists came to power. In Lebanon, the fundamentalists came to power. In Iran, when they had an election, the fundamentalists came to power. In Iraq, we introduced democracy, and what happens? The fundamentalists come to power. There's a contradiction here in American policy, because, the U.S. is trying to make countries democracies, but whenever they have an election, the fundamentalists always come to power. And they hate us even more. So it might be better if we leave the dictators in, because at least they deal with the fundamentalists. Same thing's happening in Latin America, by the way. As we force countries to become democracies, they put in governments that are anti-American. So, maybe we should just forget about spreading democracy. Anyway, that's another subject. But let's have a look at the book of Esther, because Esther is an encouraging book. Because, no matter what happens and no matter what the threats may be, we need to understand that God is not going to allow either the Jews or this tribe of Israel, Joseph, Manasseh, to be wiped out, because that is not a part of God's plan. Now, exactly how things will work out, I don't know. But the book of Esther helps us understand that God, does have his hand in things, and God does save his people. Not always the way that you expect, and not always in the time frame that you would like. But I think also the book of Esther helps us think about something else too. Why is it that everybody always wants to wipe out the Jews? It's a good question. And why is it that out of 195 countries in the world, because another one was born this week, a country of Montenegro, so we're getting up there to 200. But as out of 195 countries in the world, why is it that everybody seems to hate the United States, Britain, and Israel primarily? Not everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but you see this more and more in different countries. So let's have a look at the book of Esther, and a lot of reading, but I hope you'll follow along with me as I explain the book to you. Let's get the background initially by looking at the first two chapters. Now, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces, from India to Ethiopia. So this was the greatest power of its day, from India to Ethiopia. Just imagine that. So it was ruling northeast Africa, right across to India. That was the whole of the Persian Empire. 127 provinces. Some of these provinces later on became countries themselves. So you're talking here about a huge empire, which was the biggest in the world at that particular time. Now, Ahasuerus is the same as King Xerxes I in history. So if you look this up in the encyclopedia, it would probably say Xerxes I. And the reason why you sometimes have different names is because different countries with different languages would have a different name for people. So, for example, when I go to Africa, I am Rhodes, Mr. Rhodes, because, you know, that is the name. And everybody says Pastor Melvin, because I try to stop them saying Rhodes, so that now they say Pastor Melvin. You see, it's according to the custom in different countries. And, you know, Tom Clark got called Pastor Tom because they couldn't get his name right either. And it's the same kind of thing. And it's the same with, like, in Iraq, for example. We talk about Saddam Hussein. Sometimes I hear on TV, President Hussein. They should not have said that, because he's actually Saddam, President Saddam. The last name comes first. That is true in the Far East as well. You know, if you see somebody called Lee, for example, the first name is often Lee. That is actually the family name, and it comes first. So here, it's not Floyd Lee, it's Lee Floyd. That's the way you should say it, okay? So we can start this confusion after church today. Anyway, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, Shushan, or Susa, was the capital, one of the capitals, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants. The powers of Persia and Media, these two kingdoms that had come together, the Medes and the Persians, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all, for half a year then this was going on, some sort of a jubilee, some sort of a big celebration. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains, fastened with cords of fine linen and purple and silver rods and marble pillars. And the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. You didn't have to drink if you didn't want to. For so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And, you know, today, even today, you know, the sexes are separated in most respects, most of the time. In the Middle East, they are in Africa too. You know, it's very difficult sometimes to try and get the women together with the men, because people look at you bewildered, you know, why? So generally you meet with the men, and you might meet the women, but you meet them in the kitchen, which is outside, by the way, in the yard, not the kitchen as we understand it. But anyway, Queen Vashti obviously also had her own court. She made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Bistra, Harbona, Bigtar, and all these other people, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown. Now, realize, you know, the eunuchs are in charge of all the women. There's a great big harem, and this, again, was perfectly normal and was practiced and probably still is practiced today in many Middle Eastern countries. So, you know, you put eunuchs in charge of the women. You don't put men who can still function in charge. So these eunuchs were in charge of these women. And they were ordered to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to uphold, to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice, those closest to him being, and he mentions a number of different names, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. What shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs? And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report. King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. So they feared a general uprising of the wives here throughout the kingdom. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they've heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered. Remember, you see that in Daniel a lot. Whenever a law was passed by the king of the Medes and the Persians, the law could not be changed. That Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus. So here was the decree. Basically, she was banished. She was no longer his wife. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So she was no longer queen. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man shall be master in his own house, and speak in the language of his own people. In other words, whatever language the people spoke, that would be the way it is. The man's in charge. And remember, in an empire that big, there must have been many languages spoken. So now chapter 2, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel into the women's quarters under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young women, that let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. In Shushan the citadel there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. It is thought, by the way, that Mordecai wrote this book, the book of Esther. And by the way, it's the only book in the Bible that doesn't mention God. But it doesn't mean God isn't present in it, as you shall see. It's also the only book of the Old Testament which was not found when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. But again, that doesn't invalidate it. It is accepted as a genuine, authentic book of the Old Testament by the Jews. And you know, also it is the basis of one of their annual festivals, the Feast of Purim, which celebrates the deliverance of the Jews, as you'll see through this book. The Feast of Purim is not commanded, it's not a holy day. It's similar, if you like, it's equal to our, say, Memorial Day or Thanksgiving Day. Nothing wrong with either of them. It's not pagan, it's not like Christmas or Easter, but it's not a commanded holy day for us. So in Shushan the citadel there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So at the same time as Daniel in about 605 BC, so roughly 120 years before this, his ancestors had been taken into captivity into Babylon. And Babylon then in 539 BC was conquered by Persia. And Mordecai brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace. And he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. So she was told not to say that she was a Jew. Perhaps they were still looked down upon because they had been slaves before. And then Cyrus the Great had freed them from slavery, but they still might have been frowned upon in some way. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Each young woman's turn came to go in to King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation. So there was this 12 months preparation period to prepare her to go in for the king. You know, maybe she was taught submission during that 12 months because of the problem with, Queen Vashti. I don't know. But, there was that. Plus also, preparing her in royal protocol and how not to contradict the king and so on. And there were physical things as well that would have been done. So this went on for 12 months, according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shajgaz, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines. She would not go in to the king again, unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Now, understand that even if she never went to the king again, if he never asked for her again, it doesn't mean that she could go out and marry somebody else. She belonged to the king, and he didn't want her, going with other men. So, this was her life for the rest of her life. I'm going to take my jacket off. It's kind of hot. Is the air conditioning not working? It's not working today? Okay. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gates, and when all the women were gathered together. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, 2 of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So, Mordecai was able to, save the king from this assassination attempt, which is what it was. And so the men responsible were then investigated and were hanged. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha of the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. So, here we see Haman now, who is one of the other most important characters here in this particular book. Esther, Mordecai, and Haman would be the 3 most important ones, along with the king. So all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman. Now, Persian leaders were considered divine. But of course, the Jews would not bow down to anybody who was considered divine. You know, they would only bow down to God, to the true God. So they wouldn't accept, you know, a pagan God. This was a reason why, you know, when the Jews would not worship the Roman emperors, they became a problem. And that led to the Jewish revolt in the first century. So this has been a major problem, you know, for the Jews throughout history. And of course also for God's spiritual as well, the church. The fact that people would not compromise with them. So Mordecai would not bow down to Haman. So then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now it happened, when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, that they told this to Haman, to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. So it was understood that the Jews would not do this, and, you know, perhaps they even exempted the Jews, because that happens sometimes. But in this particular case, that was not going to happen. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. See, so here, Haman wanted to wipe out all the Jews, not just Mordecai. Indeed, instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. So it wasn't enough just to kill Mordecai for not bowing down. He wanted to wipe out all the Jews, because none of the Jews would bow down to him. None of them would accept his divine status and the order of things. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, P-U-R, or Pur, that is the lot. The Feast of Purim is the Feast of Lots, L-O-T-S, you know, as in gambling, or throwing lots, before Haman to determine the day and the month, until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So Haman, in other words, went and consulted the astrologers, who then threw the dice or whatever, in order to tell him, in order to interpret the signs and tell him exactly when he should move against the Jews. What was the best time to wipe out the Jews? It's kind of interesting, because Hitler was into that too, you know. So, you know, you wonder about some of the sources of the demons that get into these people and how they operate. But, you know, so he went in the first month of Nisan, which, remember, is also the month of the Passover, the days of unleavened bread. They cast Pur, that is, the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month, until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So this was done 2 days before the Passover. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples." So the Jews really did stick out, as they did in Germany, and as they do in most cultures, largely because of the Sabbath, but also because they won't bow down to idols. "Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries." I find this very interesting, because, you know, where would he get this money from? You know, the Jews had only been free of slavery for about 50 years. After Persia conquered Babylon, the Jews were freed from their slavery situation. So about 50 years later, this story is happening. But you know, the Jews tend to rise to the top economically in any society in which they operate. You know, that must have been happening here, because what Haman was saying to the king was, for every Jew I kill, you'll get 10,000, whatever their currency was, into your treasury. And of course, that delighted him. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman. Now, this is important. When the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, who was the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, you know, why does it record this? Basically, he did not read the decree. So the king didn't know exactly what was happening. And I'm sure this happens all the time. You know, when you're ruling over 127 provinces and you're the king, you may not read every single decree that is issued. and if you trust somebody, you might just simply sign it. And he handed his signet ring to Haman. So there was a financial incentive here for the king. You'll get 10,000. He doesn't mention, of course, that it's the Jews he's doing to. He just says there's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different. They won't obey you. You see, he put it in terms that the king would go for. These people are trouble. Let's get rid of them. And for everyone we get rid of, you'll get 10,000. I've forgotten what the currency was, but you'll get 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries. So the king signed this particular decree. Now in verse 10, it says that Haman was the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. Well, Haman was descended from Agag, whom Saul had spared and Samuel had killed. And he's described here as the enemy of the Jews. Now you can look back at 1 Samuel chapter 15 and read about Agag. 1 Samuel chapter 15. This will make an interesting Bible study for yourselves. I don't have time to go into it all in detail here. But here was a king whom Saul was told to kill, and Saul didn't. So Samuel had him killed. In 1 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 8, it says, he also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. And then in verse 33, Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hacked Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. So, you know, God had told Samuel to kill Agag, but he didn't. And, you know, it's kind of interesting that, again, because sometimes these things come back on us. And, you know, I mean, I remember when I lived in Rhodesia, you know, we had this, one of the terrorist leaders, Robert Mugabe, was in prison. And they let him go. And eventually, of course, it came back, and he took over the country, and it just ruined it. You know, and you have that kind of thing happening in back in biblical times too. The Israelites were often told to wipe out the people, and they didn't do as they were told because they were too soft. And then those people would rise up. The Amalekites, by the way, are the likely ancestors of the Palestinians today. You know, papers have been written on this. A lot of people think this is the case. I don't have all that material with me to hand, but the Amalekites are likely descendants of like the ancestors of the Palestinians. And the Israelites were told to wipe them out. And if they had done, imagine how different things would be today for the Israelis and also for ourselves. So anyway, that's the story of Haman. The king said to Haman, the money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you. So the king just said, just deal with it. Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written, according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province according to its script, and to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. So, about 11 months later. In fact, if you want the exact dates, the decree was issued on April the 17th in 484 BC, and was to be effective on March the 7th, I'm sorry, 474 BC, I should have said, and was effective March the 7th, 473 BC, 11 months later. Okay, that is when the Jews were all to be wiped out. So, you know, this is very similar to the final solution. The paper that was drawn up as the Nazi policy, I haven't seen it, but I did see in Ghana, there was a trailer advertising a movie called Conspiracy, and I made a note to try and borrow it when I get back here. It was made a couple of years ago, but it actually covers that meeting when all the Nazi leaders got together and decided on the final solution to wipe out all the Jewish people. And, you know, it looked kind of interesting from the trailer that I saw. I don't know whether it's any good or not. But, you know, that was the policy. And here was the same thing happening 2,500 years ago. So in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. You know, you wonder how much of a motive that was, because it certainly was for the Nazis. The Jews were rich, and they wanted all the wealth of the Jews, even including their gold fillings, remember. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. You know, people didn't understand this. So now we come to chapter 4, and it all builds up here to wipe out the Jews. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. At least Mordecai understood what was happening. Many of the Jews in Nazi Germany didn't believe it would happen. You know, a lot of people, a lot of those who survived have said that, you know, their moms and their dads all said, you know, a land that gave us Beethoven and Bach can't possibly turn against the Jews. I mean, this is, you know, the way that people thought. But of course, it happened. Mordecai at least could see what was going to happen. He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. And many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Now realize this decree would have taken a long time to get to all the different provinces, perhaps as long as 6 months. I say that because in 1833, when Britain abolished slavery, it took 6 months for all the different colonies to be notified. That was 1833. This was the 5th century B.C. So it would have taken a long time to get these messages to everybody. So there was great mourning as the news spread. So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai. Now understand here, Esther does not know what's happening at this point. What she's been told here is that Mordecai is outside the palace dressed in sackcloth. That's why she's distressed. Why is he in sackcloth? Sackcloth means he's in mourning, that something terrible has happened. He's fasting. So that's what she's concerned about here. So she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and take his sackcloth away from him, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. Why is he fasting? So Hatak went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. So Hatak returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Then Esther spoke to Hatak and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king, who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. You know, remember that assassination attempt. So here's the rule. Nobody can come into the king unless the king holds out the golden scepter. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So Esther realized, you know, by going into the king, she was taking her life into her hands. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place." So Mordecai had faith. He knew that God would deliver his people. Relief and deliverance will arise from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And this really is the most important verse in the book of Esther. You know, maybe he's telling Esther, maybe the reason you are there, maybe the reason you're there in the royal palace and you are the queen is because God wants you there to save his people. And that's the reason you're there. So he's putting it on her. I mean, she is the most influential Jew in the empire of Persia, although women have no role politically. So influential in one sense, you know, as a wife is over her husband, but in this case with no authority, so to speak. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." You know, she can't go in to the king except by invitation, but she was going to force something and didn't know what, but let everybody fast and pray for 3 days. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. And we come to chapter 5. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robe and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance of the house. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your response? Or what is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom." So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." So it would appear from this that she sensed that this was not the right time to ask for the salvation of the Jewish people. So, you know, she's kind of saying here, you know, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him. Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? After half the kingdom, it shall be done." Then Esther answered and said, "My petition and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them. And tomorrow I will do as the king has said." And now we see how things develop. So Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. You know, why would he be joyful and with a glad heart? Well, you know, the king and queen, remember Esther is queen, and Ahasuerus is the king, have invited Haman to a banquet, just the three of them. So where does that put him? You know, right at the top in his mind. So, you know, this is why he had such a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, so he comes out and immediately he sees Mordecai, the one guy who won't bow down to him, sitting there, that he did not stand or tremble before him. He was filled with indignation against Mordecai, because now he thought that he was a part of this trinity, the king, queen, and Haman. And Mordecai still wouldn't bow down to him. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. And he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, "Besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her, along with the king. Yet all this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." So this incredible hatred of Mordecai. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet." And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Chapter 6, that night the king could not sleep, so one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. There's a lesson here in verse 1. You see, the king couldn't sleep, so he asked somebody to bring the history books and read them to him, and that would put him to sleep immediately. Anyway, I don't think that's what he meant. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigtana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Now look here and see how God works things out. Okay? Esther's hesitation or delay allowed the king to have this sleepless night, which began a trail of events. God was working things out. In fact, Tyndale's commentary puts it this way in Esther chapter 6, God's sovereign hand is seen working through seemingly insignificant events. It was found written that Mordecai had told of that assassination attempt. Mordecai was the one who had saved the king. So in verse 3, the king said, "What honor or dignity had been bestowed on Mordecai for this. And the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. So the king said, well, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. You see the timing here? It's amazing. The king's servant said to him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. You see, Haman thought all this would come to him. Look at Proverbs 16 and verse 18 for a moment. Proverbs 16 and verse 18 says, pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken. So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Afterward Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai before you had begun to fall as of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. You know, I feel like writing that to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Look at Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12. We can begin in verse 1 and go through to verse 3, because this is one of those laws of God, and I have never seen it fail. In all the different countries that I've been to, this always works. Always. The Lord has said to Abraham, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. The last part of that verse is the spiritual promise of Jesus Christ coming to give everybody the opportunity for salvation. So the first part of verse 3, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, still applies. You know, nations that curse the Israelites suffer for it, and nations that, you know, want to be friends with the Israelites are blessed for it. Just in Zambia last month, for example, Zambia was a very poor country, and has started allowing people of Israelite descent, mostly British people, but other nationalities as well, coming to Zambia to farm. And there's only like about 100 of them, and they've increased the food production by 30% just in 2 years. So the price of food is coming down, the economy is starting to boom, the Zambians, you know, all Africans, are all saying, wow, it's amazing what a difference just 100 white farmers make to the country. And you see, it just illustrates this point. Now, obviously, Haman's relatives understood this. Go against the Jews, and you will suffer. Look what happened to the Nazis. You know, they tried to wipe out the Jews. Who got wiped out? The Nazis. So, you know, they're telling him here, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and on the second day of the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you, and what is your request? Up to half the kingdom it shall be done. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. This is the first time she said she's a Jew. She's letting out that she's a Jew now. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he, and where is he, who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing, to try to wipe out the Jews?" And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Remember, there's just the three of them there. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. This means he had touched her. Okay? And, you know, that is, even today in monarchies, you still cannot touch the monarch, which is a sensible precaution against assassination. But he had touched the queen here. That doesn't mean he touched her improperly. Apparently in the custom, you know, if you really wanted to beg for mercy, you'd kind of grab the foot of the person that you were, you get down on your knees and touch the foot of the person and beg them for mercy. But of course, this was the queen who he could not touch. And at this point, the king said, "Will he also assault the queen while I am in the house?" As the word left the king's mouth, it covered Haman's face. That means to take him to the gallows. You know, where they put, used to put a cover over your face so you couldn't see that you were being hanged. Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. Story isn't over yet, because remember, the decree was still there that all the Jews would be wiped out in a few months or a few weeks, maybe at this time. And the decree could not be rescinded. Remember, a lot of the Medes and Persians could not be changed. So even though Haman was now gone, it doesn't mean that the Jews were saved. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. This king was a bit clueless, because here he is again, giving a signet ring without reading the papers. You know, maybe he just didn't like reading, I don't know, but, you know, he hadn't learned his lesson. Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king, and said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen?" Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai, "Indeed, I've given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke." So they had to write a decree that somehow would revoke the previous decree without actually undoing the previous decree, which could not be undone. It's ingenious the way it's done. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. And it was written, according to all that Mordecai commanded, to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses bred from swift steeds. So, you know, it took months to get these messages to all the provinces of the empire. By these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives. So this was the new decree. It gave the Jews the authority to defend themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. so the Jews could fight back, which, by the way, they were not really able to do in the Third Reich, because they had no country. And this is one reason why the Jews today will not compromise their country, because without a country, they cannot defend themselves. On one day, in all the promises of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, so they were given authority on the same day that they were to be wiped out, to defend themselves with all force necessary. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published for all people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews, because fear of the Jews fell upon them. So the people realized from this second decree that the Jews were now favored by the king. So people were converting to Judaism in order to, you know, receive the same favor. Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could withstand them, because the spirit of them all fell upon all people. And all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work, helped the Jews, because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. Mordecai now was prime minister. For Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For this man Mordecai became increasingly prominent. Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. And in Shushan, the citadel, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. It lists all their names there in verse 10. The 10 sons of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, they killed. But they did not lay a hand on the plunder. See, that is mentioned. They did not make any financial gain from this, because that would have taken away from what they were doing. On that day, the number of those who were killed in Shushan, the citadel, was brought to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the citadel, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces?" The news of that would come later. "Now what is your petition? It shall be granted to you. Or what is your further request? It shall be done." Then Esther said, "If it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to do again tomorrow according to today's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows." You know, so they were not dead yet, obviously. So, you know, some rumor must have reached them that something else was going to be done the next day. So, "If it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews to do again tomorrow what's been done today." Look at Deuteronomy chapter 24. Deuteronomy 24 and verse 16. Because this would appear to contradict this particular verse. In Deuteronomy 24, verse 16, it says, "Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. The person shall be put to death for his own sin." So this would suggest that Haman's 10 sons were planning some kind of a revenge attack the day after the Jews defended themselves. So the Jews only had the authority to fight back for one day. So the Haman's sons were waiting until the next day to do something. That's the implication here. So Esther asked for a decree that they could defend themselves another day. So the king commanded this to be done. The decree was issued in Shushan, just the one city, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. And the Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men at Shushan, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. The remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives, had rest from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of their enemies, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. So that's mentioned a few times. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, And on the 14th of the month, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day as well as on the 14th, and on the 15th of the month they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled towns celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar with gladness and feasting as a holiday and for sending presents to one another. And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews near and far who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar. This is a command from Mordecai, not from God. So again, it's not binding religiously. As the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun, as Mordecai had written to them. Because Haman, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them, and had cast pure, that is the lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letter that this wicked plot which Haman had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, what they had seen concerning this matter and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants, and all who would join them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year, according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city, that these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants. And it's still kept. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, with words of peace and truth, to confirm these days of Purim at their appointed time, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had prescribed for them, and as they had decreed for themselves and their descendants concerning matters of their fasting and lamenting. So the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. And King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the land and on the islands of the sea. Now all the acts of his power and his might, and the account of the greatness of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of all his people, and speaking peace to all his countrymen. It's interesting to note, by the way, in history, by 465 BC, historical records show that Mordecai was replaced by another leader. So he stayed as prime minister for about 8 years after this happened. So there's two lessons from this book which are important for today. The first lesson is that God allows us to experience some of the horrors this world goes through. I mean, this is obviously, this was a horrible thing that the Jews went through. We're not immune to these things. But I think we can also take hope from the fact that God will deliver his people. Look at Matthew 24, just as a final verse to look at here. I can say this, I don't know how things will work out with Iran, but I know they will, somehow. We know God's plan and we know the basic outline of what's going to happen. And in Matthew 24, where Christ talks about end time events, he says in verse 22, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But to the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Christ does intervene to save spiritual Israel and also physical Israel, because in the world tomorrow, there are plenty of prophecies about how God returns the Israelites and the Jews. The Jews being the two tribes of Israel and the Israelites being the other 10, how they return to their homeland. So, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is just one of a long line of people who try to wipe out the Jews. He may take a few, may kill a few, but he's not going to wipe out the Jews any more than Hitler did or any of these other people in history did. Well, I hope to see you all at Old Country.